Hello, it's Tuesday, the 15th of October. I'm Alec Hogg, and welcome to NewsWrap. In this episode, farmers give a big thumbs up to John Steenhuisen, the new Minister of Agriculture. Big thumbs down, though, for Gautrain and its initiator of another expansion plan, the Gauteng Premier. Excitement about the investment potential for South African property and even in Gauteng. South Africa's 2024 rebound from a very poor start to the year could be setting us up for a terrific 2025. And this year's Nobel Prize winner for economics will be telling us how fixing corruption is the secret sauce to make economies better. Just to remind you that NewsWrap's sister program, BizNews Briefing, is broadcast live every morning at 7 a.m. Please join us tomorrow. To find the link, go on to biznews.com. Well, first, some good news at last for John Steenhuisen. He's been under fire since being appointed as Minister of Agriculture. But not everybody believes, and certainly those on the ground, that he deserves this criticism. Here's the chairman of Grain South Africa, Derek Matthews, on the DA Leader.
John's choice of advisors and staff are politically challenging and has solicited all the comments that it has. For us on the ground who deal with the Department of Agriculture and deal, and have had relationships with the Minister of Agriculture all along and absolutely depend on those relationships to be very good and effective, we're finding that despite that political challenge that he might have with those people, John is actually doing a great job of getting things done, of actually where in the past we would put issues on the table with the minister. And you could only hope that, by the time the next time you see her a year or the minister a year or two down the line that something would have happened. Whereas, since John has been in office, there have been a number of issues put on the table. They've been dealt with and they've been executed. So irrespective of the political issues that he's having, functionally, the department is working. It's actually, I find John to be somebody who really listens. He makes an assessment of what is needed. He will hear us very clearly, and then he will action it. He will decide on what the solution is, what is required, and he will do it. From that point of view, he's serving us very well.
It was an interesting portfolio, first of all, for him to be offered, and secondly, for him to have accepted. Why do you think that Ramaphosa gave his greatest political rival this opportunity?
That's a question that I've spent many hours actually pondering and wondering why. I really don't understand. I don't know if somebody or if Ramaphosa might have thought that it's less important or it's less, you can do the least damage there if you want to say. I don't really know why he chose it. But as I said, from our experience in the last three months now, it's really, things are working.
While Steenhuisen's image looks to be recovering, Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi, it just lurches from one crisis to the next. Latest is his 120 billion rand taxpayer-funded expansion for the loss-making Gautrain. The Automobile Association's Leighton Beard has been outspoken. My colleague Chris Steyn spoke to him today.
But you've got to ask these questions. A, can we afford it? As you've done, is it something that we can spend 120 billion rand on? Are we going to get that investment back somehow? Now, when you look at the projected figures for phase one and the shortfall in the number of, in the ridership levels, are there any projections that could be credible in that environment? And in our view, no, there can't be, because they've already proven that that the projections aren't credible. So if it doesn't achieve 130,000 riders a day, it gets compensated by the Gauteng provincial government for whatever the shortfall is. So if it predicted 130,000 riders a day and it only gets 42,000 riders a day, on a month basis or on an annual basis, that's obviously calculated. So where it says we're going to get 47 million people to use our system a year, and in this year we've only had 13 million people using our service, they get compensated for that shortfall. And that is known as the patronage guarantee. And that's not our wording. That's wording that is used in the Gautrain contracts. And if you read any of the Gautrain Management Agency annual reports dating back to 2012, they use that terminology and they say we need to increase our ridership to avoid having to pay this patronage guarantee. And the patronage guarantee is incredibly onerous on the Gauteng provincial government and therefore on Gauteng taxpayers. In the 2023-24 financial report, it's indicated that the Gauteng Department of Roads and Transport, from their budget, paid the Gautrain Management Agency almost 3 billion rand for the patronage guarantee. In the previous 10 years, it was close to around 22 billion rand. That gets taken from the Gauteng Department of Roads and Transport's budget and gets given to the Gautrain Management Agency, who then pays the private concessionaire, Bombela, that money as an insurance for low ridership levels. And so obviously we take issue with that because it's taking money from the Gauteng provincial government that in our view could be used, must be used, should be used for the improvement of other roads infrastructure in the province and given to a private company because they didn't manage to get the number of riders that they projected they would get.
A straight shooting approach and never getting married to a single idea has been part of the formula for the success of Magnus Haystack, independent financial advisor, and his Brenthurst Group. Haystack explained how he's now changed his mind about the investability of South Africa, and in particular, the long-term asset of property, even in Gauteng. I spoke to him earlier today.
You know, up to about a year ago, for the last 7 years, the listed property sector was not a great place to be for South Africa. You know, the listed property was battling with very high interest rates, increased vacancies. It had the COVID lockdown, and it also had the maladministration of the big cities in the country, and rates and taxes, electricity, solar panels. You know, it was a perfect storm against the owners of these properties. And about 7-8 months ago, Kilian Ndlovu, who is a good friend of mine, he used to be at Stanlib, their property expert. He went on a sabbatical and he's now a consultant. He started whispering in my ear. He said, "Magnus, you need to look at the listed property sector." And I said to him, "Ach, no, Kilian, I'm not interested. It's all negative." And he quietly convinced me in his usual way that there's substantial value in our big listed stocks. And over time, I started tracking those funds and started using them slightly. But I wasn't initially convinced that this is a big turnaround. But, you know, here we are 6 months, 8 months later. The returns are in excess of 50%. And it just shows you it's one of these almost hidden, not discussed in the media, hoorahs about the big returns. And suddenly those guys are worth 50% more than 8 months ago. It's just another lesson in financial markets that we will never stop learning. You do not read the headlines all the time if you want to make good investment returns. Go and search a little bit harder for value. And we had the same. I see gold is also up 50% in rand terms. But the listed property space is very intriguing. If the vacancies start rising, especially in the office space, and I'll come back to that in a second. Plus, you have electricity costs not under that much pressure, and you have interest rates coming down very importantly. There can be further value to be found in the listed property space.
Another innovative thinker in the financial space is Paul Cunahan, who's the Chief Wealth Officer of Fed Group. He also sees South Africa as a glass half full. You know, it's been so interesting to me that Franz Cronier and others from their research have said, but South Africans are conservative. Yes, you get these crazy guys on the fringes who try to make trouble for the rest of us, but actually as a nation, all we want is to have a better future for our children, get rid of this bloody corruption, and move forward in that way. And maybe at last this is happening. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just thinking about it, and you're right, I probably under-amplified the difference. It really has been a tale of two halves this year, hasn't it? It's almost like my golf game. I go out and play a decent first nine, and somehow over a Sami and an Energade, the golf game, you know, dissipates in the second nine. But in relation to ourselves, the first nine was tough. It really was. And actually leading up to that, we had a whole bunch of things go wrong. But yes, absolutely. We're in a bit of a purple patch at the moment now. You know, that is driven by a lot of good things happening all at once. And, you know, I like to say as well, we are fully plugged in as a country into the global economy. So often, you know, what we are achieving, you know, when things are going well like they are now, with positive signs, green shoots, we sort of 50% is our efforts. You know, it's got to do with, you know, the luck that we create. And then 50% we are plugged into the global economy, you know, and that's an important point I wanted to make, is the fact that, you know, we need to do what we can do to influence the future that we have, because, you know, sometimes we are not totally in control of the global economies and the global marketplace that will have an effect on us, you know, with all the eventful stuff coming up now, like US elections, et cetera, et cetera.
Englishman Simon Johnson, who's a graduate of Oxford University and is now tenured as professor of global economics at the prestigious MIT in Boston, won this year's Nobel Prize for Economics alongside his two co-authors of a book on the struggle between technological progress and how mankind's prosperity can be shared when things do improve. He spoke to Tom Keane of Bloomberg about the impact of the US presidential election, colonization, and corruption.
I think technology drives everything, Tom. You're well aware of that. And the question is, whose technology? Who has what priority? What's their vision? Is it an inclusive vision, or is it a vision which only a few people have good jobs and everybody else is really scrambling? That's been super important over the last 250 years. We've had some good episodes and some really bad ones. And I think it's all in play again with artificial intelligence.
In play with this, Simon Johnson, is this election. I mentioned this the other day. It parallels 1840, 1850. There's almost a Luddite part of America that is afraid of the consequences of technology. What is the Acemoglu Johnson Robinson prescription?
Well, Daron and Jim should speak for themselves. But my view, Tom, is that technology has hurt people. We've had excessive automation in the past 40 years. We've not generated enough new good jobs, so jobs where you actually get paid good money and you can live well. And we've got to do better on that. I think that that's really a fundamental driving importance, irrespective of the election outcome. Where are the good jobs going to come from? And can we keep pace with or get ahead of automation? Because, you know, automation is going to happen, like it or not. So you really got to work a lot harder to generate more science, more technology, deploy that, commercialize that, scale that up, and generate more good jobs all across the country. Can be done, but it's a top priority, and I think it needs to be elevated as a priority right now.
All right, so Simon, with your two colleagues and your work here, I mean, it just raises a question which is so relevant even today, discerning why some countries are rich and some much poorer. How should we think about that big, big picture question these days?
Well, I suggest we think about it in two ways. One is the sort of deep history and recognize that we've all got these legacies that we're living with. And some of these legacies, particularly if you were colonized in a harsh way by the Europeans. That's a very tough legacy to overcome. But the second thing is, there's no predestination. It's all about the choices that you make, including technology that we just talked about, if you're in the United States. But around the world, I would point to corruption. I mean, corruption's been, as you guys know, talked about a lot over the past 30, 40 years. But what do we have? We still have immense amounts of corruption. And there's two sides to that. There's the people who pay the bribes and the people who take the bribes. And that's a big part of what holds a lot of countries deeply in the poverty that you see today.
I trust you enjoyed this episode of NewsWrap. Don't forget, tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., that is, we have the first live streaming of BizNews Briefing. Join me then for the link. You can get it on biznews.com. Until then, from Alec Hogg, cheerio.